From an evolutionary perspective, one thing humans are, unfortunately, very good at is out-competing other species. The other way of saying this is, of course, that we're making plants and animals extinct. Around the world, animal populations have plummeted by 70% in the past half a decade or so. And, as it currently stands, one-third of plants and animals could face extinction by 2070. But what if there was a way to make those plants and animals more resilient to the changing climate and the habitat loss that threatens their existence? Professor Paul Sunnox is the co-leader of the Wildlife Genetic Management Group at Monash University. For decades, he's been at the forefront of what's called assisted evolution, the process of giving species a little bit of a helping hand. Paul, welcome to you.
Thanks, Andy. And yeah, very nice intro.
Paul, you like to use the term genetic rescue for the work you do. When did you first realise the role that humans could play in helping plants and animals become more resilient?
It's been fairly much at the forefront of my career and the field that I work in since its beginnings. I think it's important to emphasise that what we're really talking about is allowing nature and helping nature to do its thing. There are some more invasive technological approaches that could be applied in genetic management of wildlife, but the great majority of how we think about it in my group and with a lot of my colleagues is that we ought to be allowing nature to continue doing what it's doing by helping populations maintain the natural genetic variation that they have and harnessing the genetic variation that they have within their own species.
Tell me about the helmeted honeyeater. This is one animal that you've worked with extensively. What are the challenges that it faces in particular?
So the helmeted honeyeater is actually a beautiful example of conservation biology in action. Like many species that are severely threatened by humans, its major problem was that it lost over 99% of its habitat. And when populations become small and isolated, they inevitably lose genetic variation. And that genetic variation is absolutely essential for the health of individuals and their ability to respond to new and current threats.
So what are the traits that would give the helmeted honeyeater a better chance of survival? What sort of process did you go through?
So genetic problems can be thought of in three ways. I think most people are fairly familiar with the idea of inbreeding. The reason that there are incest and marriage conventions in human societies is that inbreeding is very, very bad for people, and it's bad for pretty much all wildlife. The second sort of genetic variation is having good versions of genetic variation in a population. And then the third type is having diversity to deal with whatever might come into the future. So one of the main things that we demonstrated with helmeted honeyeaters was that they had that first problem, the inbreeding problem, to a pretty massive extent. We showed that the most inbred helmeted honeyeater left only 10% as many offspring in its whole lifetime as the most non-inbred helmeted honeyeater. So inbreeding depression is the name given to the harm of being inbred. Isn't just some minor fringe issue. It can be a complete game changer.
You've worked with other species as well, the leadbeater possum, Macquarie perch, and an endangered daisy, to name a few. Yeah. What's your record been like with these plants and animals? Are there tangible outcomes in terms of improving population or a measurement of improving resilience?
Absolutely. And not only our work, but the vast majority of cases where genetic management has been applied. Sometimes humans actually deliberately cause genetic augmentation, so the provision of more genetic variation that's suitable for a population. And sometimes it happens sort of naturally, but in virtually all cases, the benefits are really, really major. With helmeted honeyeaters, we've just published a paper showing that crossing them with their closest relative allows them to leave more fledglings in captivity, and we're now seeing how that pans out in the wild. But from our own work, one of my favourite examples is the Macquarie perch, a freshwater fish that was extinct in the Ovens River. It was restocked after the Ovens River was improved to remove the problems that had made the species go extinct in the first place. But it wasn't until our colleagues at the Victorian Department of Environment introduced, worked to improve the habitat and then introduce fish with suitable genetic diversity that things really took off. And now the species is doing very, very well in the Ovens River. But even more, the genetically diverse fish in the Ovens River are the ones that are swimming out of the Ovens and into adjoining rivers where they've not been seen for many, many decades. And so this sort of genetic management, if you get it right, can be something that's just a gift that keeps on giving. It's basically doing conservation for you while you're off doing other things or asleep.
If you've just joined me on RN Drive, Professor Paul Sunnucks is the co-leader of the Wildlife Genetic Management Group at Monash University. We're discussing the concept of genetic rescue, where humans intentionally help animals develop more resilience. I think Australians are particularly aware, Paul, about the risks of trying to sort of bioengineer solutions to human problems. I think the cane toad is probably foremost amongst the examples here. Is there a risk that you might breed species that actually result in an animal which is less resilient than its parents?
There are risks of everything. And if we never did anything because there was a risk, we would never do anything. When you go to the doctor, you're weighing up the risk of doing one thing, the risk of doing another thing, and the risk of doing nothing, and the benefits. And so if we apply an evidence-based decision-making process to thinking about the best way to prevent extinction or whatever our conservation goal is, if we have a decision-making process, we can make the best decisions. We can try them. Very often, if we don't like the outcomes that we're getting, we can adjust things and go through a cycle of improvement. There are some risks, but as I say, there are risks to everything. And a lot of the risks of genetic management have been greatly overstated and, in fact, contrary to the evidence.
Why do you think they've been overstated? For what reason?
Well, one of the main risks that people are concerned with is a thing called outbreeding depression, which is the harm that you get from bringing together parents that are too different. And a popular, well-known example is a horse and a donkey, when they're mated, produce a sterile mule. So if we did that in a conservation setting, that would be a bad outcome. But we know in advance, to a very, very great extent, whether we're going to do the equivalent of the horse times donkey cross. In the case of the helmeted honeyeater that you mentioned earlier, we were left with only one single population of helmeted honeyeater, and we knew that they had major genetic problems that were almost certainly going to cause extinction within a 50-year period, and so they needed more genetic variation. As they're the last of their kind, that genetic variation had to come from somewhere else. So we went through a process of scouting out the options, figuring out which one was the best option, and demonstrated in captivity that the hybrids, inverted commas, so the birds that were mixed between the helmeted honeyeater and their very, very close relative, those birds did very well. We were very, very confident that this mixing was going to go well, and indeed it has. And the same applies with the great majority of the species that people have done this technique, which is known as genetic rescue, the species that people have done that on.
I guess the question that I have is, where does this end? Because if the biosphere continues to decline and biodiversity continues to decline, there's going to be more and more examples where we are tempted to intervene in certain populations and certain species. I mean, at one point, do you start to think that we are perhaps overstepping that boundary? Is there such a thing in your view? Or do you think that there are, well, as you've written in your book on genetic management, that there are 1.4 million populations of endangered species that would continue to benefit from genetic management?
The idea of humans not intervening to save wildlife is a concept that we're several hundred years too late on. Just the headline statistic that if you put all of the mammals in the world in a huge pile and weighed them, 98% of the pile would be humans and their domestic animals. We have gone far beyond the point of allowing nature just to do its thing without our intervention. The main intervention that we can do is stop doing really stupid stuff, which we continue to do on an industrial scale. So I would love to live in a world where active genetic management wasn't necessary because humans had allowed populations to remain large and connected. But that isn't what humans have done. They've made them predominantly small and disconnected. Small and disconnected populations will develop genetic problems. And if we can alleviate those genetic problems by what are often very mild and cost-effective interventions, then I think we should be doing that. But that absolutely has to go hand in hand with reducing all of our other impacts. Habitat destruction and degradation, pollution, invasive species, over-exploitation and climate change sitting over the top of all of that, making everything more difficult.
Fascinating to talk to you. Paul Sunnox is the co-leader of the Wildlife Genetic Management Group at Monash University. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Andy. Great to talk.
You've been listening to a podcast of The Drawing Room with me, Andy Park. For more great conversations, search for The Drawing Room on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.